Good morning. I'd like to open with words from Elizabeth Strong. Today we celebrate a dream awakening. Today we worship with renewed hope in our hearts. Today we act on audacity of hope and the dreams for the future. Today we begin the hard work for injustice, for justice, equity, and compassion in all human relations. For today is like no other day. And it is ours to shape with vision and action. Let us worship together and celebrate a dream awakening. So welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Mark Clark, and I'll be convening this morning. Here find a house of welcoming. Here find vision and hope. Here be received as you truly are, unique and beautiful. Your journey acknowledged, your love honored. Let us rejoice together. I need to take care of a few announcements real quick here. First and foremost, I'd like to invite everyone to stay for a bit after the service for our coffee and dessert reception for Reverend Johnstone. I believe this coming Tuesday, it's Roots of Injustice, Seeds of Change. That may be in your flyer. Sorry, I haven't even taken a look yet. Tuesday, 7 to 9 here at the Fellowship, and you're asked to RSVP to Diane Barker or Carol Barta. Sorry. And then please come to the going away party for our dear friends, Jarlie and June Kempthorne. They've been with us for quite a while. June was a one-person chair of the grounds and facilities for many years, and that alone is a huge task. And Charlie enlightened us with about the mysteries of poetry, taught us to journal, served many times on a program committee. They both gave a forum life story for our writings, and of course they've always been delighted us with their presence and support. So we want to celebrate them being with us and unfortunately having to say goodbye. It's next Sunday, August 30th, 2 to 5 p.m., 1744 Leavenworth Street. That's Dick and Sylvia Beeman's house, by the way. The fine print is, you're instructed to bring only yourselves. There will be good food, they say. There's plenty of parking at Eugene Field School just east of the house on Leavenworth Street. So I'll see everybody here, right? Everybody. Okay. And also, don't forget about the Musicale coming up on Sunday, September 13th. If you've never been to one of these musical extravaganzas, you're missing out. I heard something about a circus animal, something, I don't know, that you're going to have to be here to find out. Trust me, you won't forget. And one last one. You're invited to attend a workshop entitled Traditional Philosophy and a Native Worldview, held at the UU on Saturday, September 26th from 9 to 5. There is a $90 fee as part of that. Traditional Kaw Elder Curtis Kikabi will share aspects of Native spirituality and traditional Native values. It's sponsored by the Flint Hills Wisdom Keepers Foundation, so see Pat Embers for more information. And the flyer that I'm reading off the back of is located in the back of the Alsop room in that rotating flyer stand. We didn't know what to call, so we're calling it the revolving flyer stand. But they look like this, so if you're interested, please pick one up. Okay. As we light the chalice, I'd like to welcome members, friends, and guests to a historic and remarkable day in the ongoing story of our fellowship, a day when one dream is realized and when many others come closer to being fulfilled. The dream of having a full-time minister is becoming our reality today, and with it the dreams of the fellowship, including growing our congregation, furthering our social action work, and building stronger bridges to the local community. Are now within our reach. Today, obviously, we're welcoming our new minister, John Lou Johnstone, and her partner, Jane Powell, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, into our community. We look towards John Lou for leadership and guidance as we travel through our common and our individual spiritual journeys. And we recognize Jane as our friend and fellow Unitarian Universalist, invite her on our journey to fulfill our dreams. A little bit about Reverend Johnstone. She comes to us from the First Unitarian Church in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where she was a program minister. Originally began working there only a few hours a week in 2002. While we'll know Reverend Johnstone personally and professionally as a Unitarian minister, her life is rich with personal and professional successes. The daughter of two public school teachers, her father returning to teaching after retiring from the Marines, Reverend Johnstone became a public school teacher specializing in special education. She earned both a bachelor's and master's degree in special education with her master's specializing in severe, profound, and multiple handicaps from Johns Hopkins University. Kind of a show-off, if you ask me. After teaching in Virginia and District of Columbia for 6 years, she moved to West Virginia to work as a behavioral specialist. When John Lou decided it was time for a change from her time in West Virginia, she shifted gears, worked part-time for a while, wrote a book. She then began to realize her fundamental need for spirituality in her life and in the lives of those around her. And so began her journey of the ministry, which ultimately brought her to us. John Lou earned her Master's of Divinity from the Harvard Divinity School in 1993 after completing an internship at the UU Church of Reading, Mass. Reading, okay. It's spelled Reading, but it's Reading. Massachusetts. Upon graduation, she accepted a position as an extension minister with the James Reeb Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Madison, Wisconsin. The only problem was there wasn't actually a James Reeb Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Manhattan that existed at that time. Instead, it was just a mailing list and 20 or so community members that formed a committee to form the church. She spent 6.5 years there, and the congregation grew to about 140 members, which is quite impressive. In 2000, Reverend Johnstone took a position as a growth consultant for the Southwest UU Conference, where she traveled through 6 states, eventually visiting 28 congregations and connecting with many others through workshops, conferences, and informal consultations. Her experience with the challenges of growing a congregation will certainly be useful when we begin our hope for growth. In August of 2002, John Lou began working a few hours a week for the First Unitarian Church in Oklahoma City. Eventually, this expanded to half-time and then three-quarter-time appointment, and then a called ministry in 2005. Her time with the First Unitarian Church was spent overseeing covenant groups, adult religious education, and other adult programs, jump-starting a young adult program, participation in worship and religious education at all levels, reorganizing from a church council to a team model for programming, working with a lifespan faith development team, working with a membership committee on improvements to welcoming new members and maintaining membership. Her passion for social justice has led her to work with a number of issues, including BGLTIQ rights, including marriage equality, go team, feminism, community-based services for people with disabilities, peace, anti-racism, and multiculturalism, local food, environmentalism, economic justice, healthcare, and more. John Lou's personal theology is theistic, but she's open to a wide-ranging points of view, as she herself draws from many sources to define her. Her Southern Baptist background coincides with her connection with the earth through her pagan training. The Tao, the Christian mysticism of Julian of Norwich, process theology, Hebrew, Buddhist, and humanist tenets all coexist within her belief system. The wide-ranging understanding of and consideration for these and other faiths allow her to see how theological positions other than her own might work for others, and interestingly, she accepts that they might actually be right. I've only barely touched on John Lou's extensive experiences and professional accomplishments. I invite you to go to the webpage if you'd like to know more. It's quite impressive. Look under the Meet Our Minister link, and you'll see a full bio there. We formally welcome Reverend Johnstone into our family by way of our vision statement, a strong symbol of what we are and what we aspire to be. The Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, rooted in a living tradition, embraces diversity in all its forms as it expands our thinking and our sense of community. Yes, please.
We are a safe haven for spiritual, intellectual, and emotional growth through honest self-examination, provocative dialogue, enriching experiences, and ever-deepening connections.
We are an incubator for the next generation of UUs, fostering spiritual. What's funny? Oh. Fostering spiritual and ethical exploration tailored to age and stage and promoting intergenerational unity.
And do.
We are a bold model of love, compassion, social action, and justice for ourselves, our society, and our planet. Welcome.
We are builders of bridges across faiths and boundaries to honor our shared humanity and common values.
Welcome, John.
We are a visible beacon of liberal religious messages of hope and meaning in our local community.
I could get the other teens that are reading to join Lily, please.
Reverend Johnstone, please accept this book, Who's Who at the UU, in hopes that it will make getting to know us a little easier.
When we learn we are getting a new minister, we are beginning looking for a project that help you and us in the transition.
We found a suggestion that a book is often assembled. This book would include information about key influencers, people who make things happen, and elected officers.
Since
Since every member of our fellowship is vital to our community, we decided that everyone, young and old, needed to be included. This book contains information on 70 adults and 29 of our youth and children.
Every social interaction you have with us right now must feel like a pop quiz. We empathize, seeing that we know how pop quizzes work, and hope that the profiles in this book will help you learn the names and other helpful information in coming weeks and months. The good news is you don't have to memorize it, and there won't be a test.
I want to quickly thank a few people. A large team group, including Destiny Maeve, Clara William, and Mia, helped envision the name and the survey questions that we put together for this. Lily and McKaylee painted our picture frame and took pictures and interviewed kids. Helen designed the cover, and Iris helped me make the final decisions on presentation. Sandy, Shirley, and Sue also helped. But most of all, I'm so impressed with the responsiveness of the fellowship and all of your willingness to share. So thank you very much, and I hope this is a good resource for you. So, group hug.
Well, thanks very much. That was amazing. Before the choir comes up, let's all thank our dear friend Gene Sabers. Where's Gene Sabers? There he is. He's our dear friend, a newly minted member, which is great, an amazing artist, for the wonderful vase and chalice that he's created and donated for today's celebration. So thanks. Now the choir will come up and lead us in our opening hymn, number 360.
I'd like to invite the children up. And we have a bunch of them. So I'm wondering if anybody started anything this week. School. A bunch of people started school. Anybody start a new grade? Okay. Did anybody start kindergarten? You did not start kindergarten. But there are some who started kindergarten. First grade? Second grade? Third grade? Fourth grade? Fifth grade? Sixth grade? Seventh grade? Eighth grade? Have we run out? Ninth grade? Tenth grade? Okay. And I'll bet that there are some other people out here thinking about the start of school besides just the children. I'll bet that there are some parents who have been thinking about it, and I'll bet there are some university-affiliated people who are thinking about the start of school. So it's a new school year, but it's still 2015, right? The year changed, but the year didn't change. So when's that going to change? In January. Okay, in January it'll be a new year. So there are different kinds of beginnings. There are different kinds of years. And beginnings don't necessarily start everything over, but they do bring changes. Anybody have a new teacher this year? Okay. Anybody have new classmates? Anybody in a new school? Yeah, yeah. So there are lots of changes with beginnings. It's not just one thing. It's like a whole bunch of things all glommed together. And that gives us a lot of different feelings. How do you feel about school starting? I see a thumbs up. I see a thumbs down. Any words? Good? Happy? Happy? Joyful. Good for the most part. Yeah, okay. So sometimes we feel happy and excited and energetic about beginnings, but sometimes we also feel a little sadness because we're giving up some other things that we had, and sometimes we're even a little afraid. I had bad dreams last night. Thinking about today, because I don't know if people are going to like me, and I don't know if everything's going to go okay, and I don't know if I'm going to be surprised by things that I don't know what to do about. Has anybody else ever felt that way? And we feel that way. We feel that way sometimes with beginnings, and I can't ignore those feelings. But I can decide where I want to focus my attention. And for me, I want to focus my attention on the hopes. And I don't mean just little hopes, like I hope I get a tuna fish sandwich for lunch, or even I hope my new teacher treats me nice, but kind of a bigger kind of hope. And I have a few hopes that I want to share with you. I hope I can be a good minister for this fellowship. And I hope that I will get to know you and your families a lot better and will be able to be a good support for you when things are good and also when things are not so good. And I hope you'll be able to depend on me. I hope that together we can make this fellowship a better and better place and that more people will come and become our friends. And I hope that everyone here is able to grow into their best selves and that the fellowship helps them to do that. And I hope that this place is here for a long time and that it's here when your children's 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 children are looking for a place to call their home church. So thank you all for listening, and we're going to sing you out to your classes. Religious community is built on many influences. It comes into being in a particular place and time, a point of beginning, but it changes through time, gradually suiting itself to shifting expectations and challenges and roles. The strongest religious communities provide sustenance to people who are in the midst of struggle, along with a place to share the celebrations of their lives. So the purpose of sharing our joys and sorrows together in religious community is to bring the most sacred and significant mileposts of our lives to the attention of others so that we can be sustained in our sorrows and find our joys multiply in the sharing of them. So in a more traditional church, this might be called the prayers of the people. Here we offer our sacred trust by inviting people into the intimacy of caring together. Are there joys or sorrows to be shared at this time?
Enel Forrester, very pleased to...
Yeah, you're right.
I'm very pleased to say that my daughter-in-law had her second knee replacement this week, and is doing fairly well, still in pain, but is doing very well. And I'm pleased and happy that she is progressing.
Several of you have asked about my sister-in-law, who was in that terrible car accident that killed her husband. While I'm still grappling with the death of her husband, I'm happy to report that my sister-in-law is in a skilled nursing facility and doing well, making progress. The fractures are not displacing, and we hope and expect that she will be able to go home soon. So thank you for all the concern you've expressed.
Jim Chanteau. Delighted to be back. I've been gone for quite a while. I came back, spent a little while in way north Europe. I toured the Baltic countries, and it just occurred to me, looking at our almost full congregation today, I saw many, many churches in that part of the world. I went to Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Finland, and Sweden. And on Sundays, their churches are empty. Very few people go. And that was Lutheran churches, Catholic churches, Orthodox churches. But here we come. I'm glad to see all my friends and neighbors here.
Harriet Yonke, I have a joy that my lily bulbs have multiplied, and I have some in plastic bags back there, and they're yellow, and I had brought some when they were blooming that some of you may have seen them. Anyway, 2 to 3 foot tall Asiatic yellow lilies.
Oh.
Klein and Stuart Stanton. We're happy to be home. We're happy to be home, especially for the new minister. And Bozeman, Montana's UUs send greetings.
And so we hold in our hearts all the joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken, acknowledging our caring for one another. One of the true sacraments of the free church is the giving and receiving of the offering. It's a recognition that the church is self-sustaining, that no one owns the responsibilities of this fellowship except those who gather and create together the congregation. The offering is a symbolic act in that sense, reaffirming our commitment to this institution and to its future. But it's a real act, too, actually sustaining the institution, allowing it to live out its mission and vision in the world. We give because we believe in this institution and what it has to offer. And I invite you to give generously this morning.
This is an excerpt from a longer poem called Four Quartets. This is part three of four, The Dry Salvages, with the lector's apologies to T.S. Eliot. I sometimes wonder if that is what Krishna meant, among other things, or one way of putting the same thing, that the future is a faded song, a royal rose or a lavender spray of wistful regret for those who are not yet here to regret, pressed between yellow leaves of a book that has never been opened, and the way up is the way down, the way forward is the way back. You cannot face it steadily, but this thing is sure, that time is no healer. The patient is no longer here. When the train starts and the passengers are settled to fruit, periodicals, and business letters, and those who saw them off have left the platform, their faces relax from grief into relief to the sleepy rhythm of 100 hours. Fare forward, travelers, not escaping from the past into different lives or into any future. You are not the same people who left that station or who will arrive at any terminus. While the narrowing rails slide behind you, watching the furrow that widens behind you, you shall not think the past is finished or the future is before us. At nightfall, in the rigging and the aerial, is a voice descanting, though not to the ear, the murmuring shell of time, and not in any language. Fare forward, you who think you are voyaging. You are not those who saw the harbor receding or those who will disembark. Here, between the hither and the farther shore, while time is withdrawn, consider the future and the past with an equal mind. At the moment which is not of action or inaction, you can receive this. On whatever sphere of being the mind of man may be intent at the time of death, that is the one action. And the time of death is every moment, the one action which shall fructify in the lives of others. And do not think of the fruit of action. Fare forward, O voyagers, O seamen, you who come to port, and you whose bodies will suffer the trial and judgment of the sea, or whatever event, this is your real destination. So Krishna, as when he administered Arjuna on the field of battle, not farewell, but fare forward, voyagers.
Now if you'll stand as you are able and join singing our second hymn, number 322, Thanks Be for These.
We sing thanks be for these because we're grateful for the times of our lives. And I appreciate that hymn because it acknowledges our thanks not only for the what we generally think of as the good times, but also for the challenges. And today, as we gather in celebration, I want to remind us of the complexity of the lives we live and the gift we have of gathering in religious community to recognize and find meaning in the lives we live, to name those life processes, to acknowledge them as gifts, and to express gratitude for those gifts. And so we begin. In a spirit of gratitude and of hope, we begin today to be together as minister and congregation. Having just come from someplace, the First Unitarian Church of Oklahoma City, where I was immersed in a series of endings, of goodbyes, I now find myself in a series of hellos, of starts, of beginnings. The move into my apartment, the first board meeting, the move into my office, the first meeting with one person after another, and now my first sermon. As I said in our Time for All Ages, beginnings carry a lot of emotional content. Happiness, excitement, anxiety, fear, a bit of sadness at what's left behind. This is a beginning not only for me, but for this congregation, which has never had a full-time minister before. Now, this is far from the first time that this fellowship has had a new beginning. There was, of course, the founding of the fellowship. Like many other UU fellowships, this one came into being in the middle of the last century, in the wake of World War II, and in the midst of the baby boom, when many people were seeking a place to raise their children that was outside traditional religion. A place where spirits could be nurtured without doctrine and dogma, and where children and adults as well could use reason and experience to forge their own beliefs about the world, rather than being told supernatural myths that they could not accept. Many of those fellowships, like this one, were in university communities, with members who valued the intellect and sought like-minded people with whom to develop and build community. These people decided to fare forward, to journey into their futures together. And this is probably not the time to elaborate on the fellowship movement and the gifts and challenges it brought to Unitarian Universalism, though I will do that in time. Fellowships began, as this one did, as lay-led congregations. And that creates a different sense of role and authority than a more traditional church that has always had a minister up front and on board to call the shots. Importantly, I too began my experience with Unitarian Universalism in fellowships. And it was a fellowship that ordained me to ministry. And this bit of history on your part and on my part give us something in common as we join our journey together. And I've heard the story of another beginning in this fellowship, one in the memory of a few more people than the founding, enough people that I've already heard the story more than once, of a time in the early 1980s when few members remained in the fellowship. And at the time, they were meeting in a house on Bluemont, and the religious education program had died for lack of children. Less than a dozen people showed up consistently on Sundays, and the congregation seriously considered closing up shop. David Hacker, Barbara's husband, was president then, and with others researched the possibilities. Would they close down and give their assets to the UU Association, or was there some way they could revitalize, get a new lease on life, find another beginning? Well, clearly, we know they didn't close. Instead, they took a huge risk. They sold their place in town and bought an old schoolhouse, which over time, with renovations and additions, has become the building in which we gather this morning. Throughout the summer, they cleaned out junk and hired a construction guy and made decisions. And by the time Fall came around, they'd created a sanctuary in the Alsop room and once again had children with a religious education program, and new people began to attend, and even though the scaffolding was still up, once more they fared forward. Each step along the way, hiring David Grimm very part-time as minister, then Michael Nelson a bit more, each step has been a new beginning and has brought with it risk and promise. Each step has held hopes and dreams, anxieties and fears, and sometimes sadness. And through each new beginning, open possibilities. It didn't clear the slate, but built on what had come before. And that's how beginnings are. They change many things all at once, but not everything. There's always a backstory. A wedding begins a marriage. And yet, does it really? I can't tell you how many couples I have married who were convinced that very little would change with their marriage ceremony. They already lived together, maybe even had a child together. At the same time, almost every couple who has gotten married has said that ceremony was a beginning. Something did change. And yet, what was the real beginning? Did that marriage begin at the ceremony, or did it begin when the couple met, or when they fell in love, or moved in together, or got engaged? Or maybe it didn't really begin until that big fight after the wedding. Or maybe it began again when one of the couple became very ill, or cheated, or realized that something just didn't feel right. Sometimes the beginnings and middles and ends are hard to sort through. No structured plot to guide the telling of the story. Not everything changes, but something does. We recognize the complexity of beginnings at graduation time because we call the ceremony commencement, which begins beginning. Yet it's also an ending as graduates say goodbye to classes and friends and way of life changes. Even deaths can be a beginning. We begin our lives again with a new identity as widow or widower or child whose parents are no longer here or parent who no longer has a child. The beginningness of the event is the introduction of a time of great change, not simply one change, but change piled upon change. Beginnings are not a single alteration, but rather are events that shake the system up and make new dreams possible and old habits impossible. While not everything is different, the changes sometimes make it hard to know what we can still grasp onto. Perhaps the clearest example of beginning is birth. Yet even here, a baby does not come ex nihil out of nothing. The moment of birth is dramatic, and suddenly there are two beings there where there had only been one, and anyone with a newborn baby, Jen, can tell you life changes. One set of parents, not Matt and Jen, somebody else, told me, we used to take showers every day and do laundry once a week, and now we do laundry every day and take showers once a week. Night and day become confused. Time loses its grounding. Staring at that new baby opens parents to eternity. And the clock's meaning recedes. But parents were fascinated with that child before they were born. They stared in wonder at the sonogram, figuring out what those weird little lines were, and held hands against a belly to feel kicks. When did this baby begin? There's a different experience for adoptive parents, but as intense for their adoption day. Where did it begin with the decision to adopt, the approval, the identification of the child that would become theirs? Layers of beginnings connected and interwoven. I no longer believe that my biography begins with my birth.
I can't tell my personal story without also telling you about my mother and father, who met in the military and courted going to Broadway shows on USO tickets, and who gave me both my genes and a nurturing environment. My story even includes my grandparents, who shaped my parents. Would I be who I am if my mother's parents hadn't run a dairy in Oklahoma? If my other grandfather hadn't come to Maine from Canada? If my parents hadn't met in the military? If my father hadn't been adopted? My beginnings go back further in time than I can even recount or recall, because I only know them from the stories that other people have told me. Finding those beginnings, looking back to our origins, has been an impulse of people since primeval times. Cultures tend to develop origin myths and creation stories early in their existence. In the beginning, says the Bible in both Genesis and John. And that's also how the Babylonian myth of Marduk's creation of the world starts. In the beginning. Some folklorists don't even call a story a myth unless it's a creation or origin tale. At the same time, few, if any, of those stories begin with absolutely nothing. They may begin with chaos, or with darkness, or with an empty world, or with the person of a god or goddess, and proceed from there to create something different. In the same way, cities and nations craft stories of how they came to be established. And none of these stories, the founding stories or the creation myths, are idle or random. They establish the essence of the civilization, defining how life is to be, how people are to act, and what has the most value. The foundational stories of the pilgrims coming to Massachusetts have shaped us, both as Americans and as Unitarians, since the pilgrims are our direct religious ancestors. Now, while we know there are other perspectives to these origin tales, the Wampanoag tribe, for example, tells a different story, we recognize these narratives have deeply influenced us. And I wonder how the beginnings of Manhattan, Kansas, have shaped this place. The early settlers came to fight for abolition of slavery and keep the southern slaveholders at bay. And protected by Fort Riley, Manhattan escaped the worst of bloody Kansas and grew up alongside the university, first established as Bluemont Central College and becoming one of the first land-grant universities. And I look forward to learning more. Origins have an impact, and sometimes long shadows. A beginning never is a complete beginning. With each new start, we leave behind some worn-out relics and adopt appealing, fresh enthusiasms. And that process can be challenging in a community where we might not all agree on which relics are worn out or which fresh enthusiasms are actually appealing. We may even have mixed feelings about it as individuals. What we know, though, is that beginnings are chock full of change. And to adapt and make the most of them, we turn to wisdom learned from many different sources. Religious sources, yes, but literature, science, philosophy, all the places that help make sense out of chaos that life throws at us. This morning I select the poet T.S. Eliot as a guide. We think of Eliot as British because he immigrated to England as a young adult, but Eliot grew up in the American Midwest, where he was the grandson of William Greenleaf Eliot, founding minister of the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis. T.S. Eliot, besides setting aside his American citizenship, also converted to the Church of England. So there are all kinds of beginnings, and we don't understand all of them. Eliot, in his really rather dismal four quartets, written in the depths of World War II, gave some guidance about the consideration of time, especially in relation to big beginnings and endings. Another part of the work that contains the excerpt Chris read this morning includes the more well-known, what we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning, and the end is where we start from. We shall not cease from our exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started, and know the place for the first time. Your former minister, Michael, quoted those words in his last blog post, and my own interpretation of Eliot is that we cannot know what is the beginning or what is the end. You shall not think the past is finished or the future is before us, he says. Fare forward, voyagers, he urges us. He draws on images from the Bhagavad Gita, where the Hindu god Krishna, disguised as a driver for the warrior Arjuna, counsels him on how to cope with a war he didn't start and hesitates to enter. The story is complex and deep and was popular with some of our early Unitarian forebears like Emerson. Krishna urges Arjuna and, by extension, all of us, to let go of the results of our actions. That's a really tough message for those of us addicted to goals and plans and accomplishments. Do not think of the fruit of action, says Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and in Eliot's poem. Yet Krishna does not counsel no action, simply letting go of the results of that action. All we can do, counsels Eliot, is to fare forward. Fare is an interesting choice of words, and poets are precise about which words they select. The usage here is unusual. We most often think of fares as payments for travel. In fact, the word originates from the Old English for journey. And I always appreciate the image of life as journey because that's my central metaphor, particularly for the spiritual life. To fare forward, then, is not to take any particular action, but simply to lean into the future. And that's sound advice for a beginning. You see, one of the things about beginnings is there's a lot we don't know. A lot I don't know about you, about this community context, about the history of this congregation, about how things work here. And there's a lot you don't know about interacting with a full-time minister, about how UUism can ground our lives, about what the life of the Spirit could mean in this context. And there's a lot neither of us know about what is to come, about who we might attract, about what this fellowship might grow into. Consider the future and the past with an equal mind, says Eliot. Our time together will be a process of sorting out meaning. We'll have to see what we want to claim from the past and how to recast it to serve our future. We'll have to decide which relics are worn out and which fresh enthusiasms we wish to pursue. And the thing is, we can't really know in the moment we make those decisions what the result will be. We can only make the choices that seem best right then. And I think that's what's meant by do not think of the fruit of action. Make the best decisions that seem reasonable. Take the actions that are laid before us and let go of the results, knowing that all we can give is our best effort and there will be successes and there will be failures. And then setting aside blame and guilt and the ego of achievement, we take the next step on the journey together. Fare forward. That, my friends, is a spiritual approach, one filled with hope. Hope not for a narrow outcome, but for a bigger dream, a vision whose shape cannot yet be seen, but which as human beings we feel compelled to name anyway. I doubt the dozen folks who made up the UU Fellowship of Manhattan when they risked moving here and rebuilding themselves could have envisioned at that time the congregation that exists today. I don't think they could have said, by 2015, we'll get a full-time minister through the developmental ministry program. In fact, the developmental ministry program didn't exist back then. And yet, those people, some of them here with us today, who's here today who remembers that time? There are several, yes. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you didn't imagine what the congregation would be today. What they had, though, was hope. Hope that helped them to take tremendous risks. Hope that sustain them along the way. And I named some of my hopes here at our beginning during the Time for All Ages. And I invite you now into just a participatory moment to consider what hope you have for our future together. As you're comfortable, I invite you to turn to someone near you and share that hope with them. Are there a few that are worth sharing with the whole group?
Stephen McBee. Many of you know I'm in the Army. I am actually changing my degree program to go for a Divinity Master's. And while my primary goal is to take the fight to the DOD and become one of the first pagan chaplains, me being a Norse pagan practitioner, should I lose that fight, I do plan to go the Universalist route.
Other hopes?
Well, we concentrated our comments on children, hoping that the children we have now will feel welcomed continuously as they grow into older and older ages and will want to stay with us through teenage years into adulthood.
Other hopes?
I sort of have two. One is that we've already made great strides with Michael becoming equals with other religious groups in the community and learning how to work compatibly with them and fruitfully. And the other is this program that's going to happen on Tuesday about trying to rectify some of the wrongs in our history with other peoples that we've subjugated or treated badly, that we can find constructive ways of healing.
I saw another hand over here.
I'm with Beth Skinner, and I were discussing that we thought it would be wonderful if we could do more in conjunction with some of the other churches in the community, and in particular maybe some black churches.
Any others? Okay. I think Larry's is going to be the last one.
Continuing some of the ones mentioned before, just that our vision will have we hope that will impact our community in the ways that our vision suggests we should go, and not just our community, but our state, which desperately needs to change so many of its perspectives.
Thank you all for sharing those things. Discovering our hopes is one way of nurturing blessing our beginning together. Poet Muriel Rukeyser wrote in her poem Elegy in Joy, not long after T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, "Nourish beginnings. Let us nourish beginnings. Not all things are blessed, but the seeds of all things are blessed. The blessing is in the seed." And I don't know whether all things are blessed, but I do resonate with her conviction that the seeds of things are blessed. So let us hold our hopes and dreams in our hearts and hold them loosely so that we can lean in and fare into the future, ready to be surprised and amazed at what is to come. So may it be. Our closing hymn, we're going to try a hymn that may be unfamiliar. It's peppy and energetic, which seems appropriate to our celebration today. And the hardest part is the accompaniment, so.
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah, I know. Number 1028 in the turquoise book.
When the fire of commitment sets our minds
Nourish beginnings. Let us nourish beginnings. Not all things are blessed, but the seeds of all things are blessed. The beginning is in the seed. Let us fare forward together, trusting the blessings we are given will ripen into fruit that today we can't imagine. Amen. Shalom and blessed be.